Subscribe to the Virgin Podcast at iTunes or via RSS. You're listening to the Virgin Podcast with Dominic Frisby.
Hello and welcome to the Virgin Podcast with me, Dominic Frisby. Now, it's a real pleasure to welcome to the show. I'm going to call you one of the godfathers of digital currency. I'm talking to John Matonis, and John has been involved in digital cash and the non-political money movement since the early 90s, and he's one of its most articulate proponents. He was a forex trader with Visa. He was a derivative trader with Sumitomo Bank. He worked for VeriSign in the late 90s, which his role was basically explaining encryption to banks. He became the CEO of Hushmail, which is an encrypted email service. And after the invention of Bitcoin, he went on to become the founding director of the Bitcoin Foundation. He left that position last year to work with several Bitcoin startups, and his website is themonetaryfuture.com. So, John Matonis, you've known for a long time that digital cash was coming, and you wrote an article in the mid to late 90s describing a world with digital cash, and then digital cash never came. For years it didn't come, and then suddenly we got Bitcoin. So why don't you describe the years before Bitcoin and then go on to talk about what an incredible breakthrough Bitcoin actually was.
Yeah, thank you, Dominic. Very happy to be here. And by the way, that article you mentioned was called Digital Cash and Monetary Freedom. And it actually got picked up and published in one of the early journals put out by the London School of Economics a couple blocks away.
Okay.
So I was very proud of that when they published that, I think, in 1996. So definitely pre-Bitcoin. And another thing that a lot of people don't understand or realize is that the digital currency movement was quite active. Even within Visa International, they had a small group of people that were working on coming out with an independent monetary unit. All of this before decentralized cryptocurrency, before Bitcoin, that could be administered by a private authority, non-governmental authority, to help in the settlement of currencies where they were unstable.
And so what stood in the way of Visa developing that? Was it a regulatory thing or a technical thing?
Yeah, it definitely was not a technical barrier. The project was ready to go. They were ready to launch. It was primarily lawyers.
Lawyers? So not government officials, just lawyers saying you won't get away with this.
Well, it was also the forecasting of some regulatory problems, but it was mainly the legal team and the threat of regulation that caused it to stall.
And so when was this? Kind of 98?
This was in the mid-90s.
Incredible. So there was going to be an
internal project, so not very well known. And then the Nobel Prize-winning economist, Friedrich von Hayek, actually gave a very interesting address to the Visa International Annual Conference in Greece one year. And he was talking about non-political money as well.
Wow. So there we go. And so carry on describing. So Visa were working on something, you were involved in. Why don't you talk about the cypherpunks movement? Were you a cypherpunk, would you say?
I was, but I'm not a full-time coder. So
okay.
My friends were cypherpunks. They were the coders. I hung around with that crew. I definitely knew who they were. The article that I wrote on digital cash was not really coming out of Visa. It was independent. My ideas were formulated while I was at Visa. But the main thing that I was trying to promote back then was that we would be going to a digital cash world, and we would do so to retain the three attributes that I saw us losing as we phase out paper cash or as governments phase out paper cash. And those three attributes are privacy, untraceability, and then irreversibility. That's why you take a 50-pound note and hand it to someone, because it comes with those three attributes. It's a bearer instrument. Once you give it to someone, they have it and you no longer have it. You also have the feature of privacy and user-defined untraceability. Now, if we get rid of paper cash and if governments get rid of paper cash, we stand as a society worldwide to lose those three attributes.
As soon as you said those three words, privacy, untraceability, and irreversibility, all sorts of moral issues are coming into my mind. You know, what if you're not doing anything wrong, why does a transaction need to be private? Surely you want some kind of reversibility. And again, if you're not doing anything wrong, why do you want a transaction to be untraceable? So talk about the importance of those three things.
Well, moral implications aside, because I don't believe that money does bad things. People do bad things. And my point in the paper and the recurring theme, I think, is that we already have those attributes today. So when you pull out a paper note, you have those three attributes that you know are referring to as somewhat morally, could be morally questionable. But when we go to something like a digital bearer instrument like Bitcoin, we're not getting any new qualities, any new subversive qualities that everyone thinks we're going to have with Bitcoin. All we're doing is retaining the same qualities and the same features that we already have with our paper cash today. So new methods of untraceability aren't being created. We just need to retain what we already have in the analog world.
Okay, this is me playing devil's advocate. If we are evolving morally, why would we want privacy, untraceability, and irreversibility anymore? I appreciate what you're saying, they're not giving us anything new, but why do we need to preserve those things with money?
Well, there are a myriad of reasons. I mean, you can imagine anyone's personal reason for wanting to use paper cash today. If you're a young woman living in a certain part of the world or a certain part of a country, you may not want to pay for an abortion that would be traceable, for instance. You may be a political prisoner. You may be a blogger somewhere who receives donations for a blog. Politics are different all around the world, and the rules are different all around the world. So what we think is politically correct somewhere may be politically incorrect somewhere else. So I don't think that it's up to us to question the reasons for why people want financial privacy. I think financial privacy is one of those things that is a fundamental human right.
Okay, so the cypher. So you were involved with the cypherpunks. The cypherpunks, by the way, was a kind of band of coders in the early 90s who believed in
mostly developers. Yeah,
yeah, and they believed what do they believe in? Free markets, small government, libertarian values, and they were attempting to realize their dream through coding and through creating...
Well, and that cryptography would be the path to stronger individualism.
There we go. So that's a kind of definition of who the cypherpunks were. And their kind of ultimate dream was this system of digital cash. And so you were involved with them, you were involved with Visa, who were working on a digital cash system. Then from there you went to VeriSign, is that right?
That's correct. I did go to VeriSign. The interesting thing about the cypherpunks, as you phrase it, is I was the coat and tie guy. I was the upstanding outsider who had a corporate job at Visa and also a corporate job at VeriSign. I was kind of like this cog in the wheel of that corporate machinery, but still having ties to the outside cypherpunks world as well.
Okay, so you had an interesting crossover position there.
Correct.
But presumably, even though you were kind of involved in the corporate world, you wanted digital cash of some kind to happen.
Exactly.
So why don't you just talk us through the noughties and this kind of period when the movement kind of fell apart and everyone almost gave up on this idea of digital cash becoming possible?
Yeah, that critical moment, I would say, was around the deterioration of a company called DigiCash, which was launched and... originally founded by David Chaum in the Netherlands. And DigiCash actually gave us some of the early cryptographic primitives that are still used in digital currency today. The thing with DigiCash, however, though, was that it was centralized. You could issue tokens, and they could, through blind digital signatures, they could be anonymous and anonymized, but you always had to go back to a central issuing mint, which would then issue another token to prove that it wasn't double spent. So it had all the great core features of private digital cash, with the one exception that it was centralized. And it was this centralized mint, which is what they called it, a central mint, which actually, I think, led to the eventual downfall of DigiCash because it created a single point of failure and a single point of weakness. So from that point forward, everyone in the private digital cash movement was always trying to overcome how could we recreate all of the attributes of DigiCash, but without the central issuing mint. And that was the one missing piece, was how to prevent a double spend without a central authority. And that was the state of nature until late 2008 when Satoshi released his paper.
And people thought that this problem of double spending was unsolvable.
Well, they knew it was solvable in a centralized fashion, of course.
Yeah.
But that created the single point of failure. So the holy grail, if you will, was to try to find a decentralized way to do it.
Okay. Now, why don't you describe what the problem of double spending is?
Sure. The problem of double spending is when you take currency or a bearer instrument digital. So a bearer instrument, the one that we all most recognize is cash, paper cash, but you could have bearer stocks as well. But with a bearer instrument like paper cash going digital, the problem that you have is that you can spend it very quickly and simultaneously in two or three different places, and the recipient may not be prepared or may not be fast enough to verify that it wasn't double spent somewhere else. So the potential for cheating exists. And this is also in the layman's eyes, they think about this as well. They say, well, look, if it's digital, can't I just spend it more times and in effect create as much as I want?
In effect, I'm sending you some digital code and you need a system to stop you. So in the same way that I send you an email or a picture and you need a system to stop you copying and pasting and sending that picture or that email to a million different people.
Absolutely. That's the essence of the double spend problem.
And it was considered insolvable unless you had a central body to ratify the transactions.
That's correct.
And the breakthrough of Bitcoin was that it solved this problem. And what was the kind of atmosphere in the cypherpunks movement? Had it kind of given up? Was it despairing? Was it
actually no? It hadn't given up. It was starting to take a new form because of what happened with Doug Jackson and Egold. And this was around 2006 to 2008, so 2 years before Satoshi. The movement started to look at ways to store gold, which would be the backing for digital cash, but to store it in a way that it couldn't be confiscated, because this is what brought down e-gold, which was another form of centralized digital currency backed by gold. When the authorities found out that they were doing transactions that were politically incorrect, they moved to confiscate the gold. So that was a weakness of a centralized system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's when people started to, this was at Black Hat conferences, at DEF CON, various places where people were trying to come up with theories and ideas of how to store gold, make it auditable, but unconfiscatable. Now, you can imagine that that's quite a large order to fill. If you need to have gold somewhere and have it properly assayed and properly audited, it just goes to, it goes to show that, well, if somebody can audit it, then a government can confiscate it.
Yeah.
So the methodology that was evolving around that time was, using a series of links and hops and different people that maybe didn't know each other, but two of three knew something and you could piece together and you could also have a provable system of vaulting gold without having it be vulnerable to confiscation. Now, those theories didn't get fully worked through. They didn't get fully baked, but they were just being started in like the 06, 07 timeframe.
Okay.
That's where it would have gone.
Okay. And digital gold got shut down, of course, eventually, and all sorts of allegations flying around and lawsuits and all the rest of it.
E-gold, you mean?
E-gold. I apologize. E-gold. And then in 2008 was the first kind of announcement about Bitcoin. So when did you first read about Bitcoin and what was your initial reaction?
Well, I first read about Bitcoin in late 2009,
okay.
Which had been about 10 months after it had been released. But even prior to that, going back to what you mentioned about the release of the Satoshi white paper, Satoshi released that, I believe, in October of 2008. And it was a back and forth question and answer session between the people who were on this cryptographer mailing list and Satoshi, who was asking for peer review. people to shoot holes in it and find bugs. That went back and forth for about 3 months till the end of December. And this is all logged somewhere, I think, where you can read it. You can go to the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute and they have it archived. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to follow through because after all of this back and forth, Satoshi said, well, you know, the only way I'm going to prove to these potential skeptics is if I release the code into the wild. And he said he was going to do that in December. On January 3rd, 2009, he actually released Bitcoin into the wild and the Genesis block was created.
That's right. And so when you first read about it, and so it was already getting established by October, November 2009. That was, in fact, when the first exchange rate was published by a Bitcoin aficionado called Liberty Standard. And by the way, this is just an interesting little fact. That initial exchange rate was, I think, 1,309 Bitcoins to $1. And he based that calculation on the amount of Bitcoins his computer generated divided by the amount of electricity it used. And everyone said he'd overvalued it. And if you bought that low and sold the high 4 years later when one Bitcoin was $1,240, the same price as an ounce of gold, you would have made almost 2 million times your money. So it really was winning the lottery.
Well, absolutely. But nobody knew it back then. It was just play tokens.
Yeah.
Back then. My original thought of it at first was, since I was stuck in the gold world, I was still trying to link it somehow to gold. Like, how can this be used to move forward e-gold? So I shelved it for about 2 months and didn't come back to it. But then I got an email from Satoshi.
Can I just say, I was heavily into gold around about the same time. And at that time, gold was in a bull market. Gold was doing really well. And I was the same, probably worse. I just had tunnel vision about gold and I just excluded everything else.
Yeah, it wasn't so much tunnel vision for me, though. It was more that how could something intangible have value? But the intangibility of Bitcoin's value is what makes it so great, because it's intangible. So, number one, you have deniability of ownership, which is fabulous. It's like, I don't have that. That's not my pile of Bitcoin over there, Mr. Officer. I can't see it. Can you see it?
Okay.
So the intangibility and the protection through the public key cryptography and the key system made it so it was unconfiscatable. And that's when I realized that it was superior to gold. And it truly was a new form of digital gold. I haven't left gold, but I think that they both play a role in someone's portfolio.
Yeah, Nick Szabo, who invented something called BitGold, which came just before Bitcoin, said his idea behind Bitcoin and his idea behind BitGold and Bitcoin is incredibly similar, was to create a digital reserve currency, which is what the role of gold once was.
Well, and BitGold was brilliant in the concepts. It was theoretical. It wasn't really coded as a product, but the theory of it and the theory behind it was excellent.
Yeah, so. And then Bitcoin started growing. Now, a lot of the things you've talked about, John, are incredibly subversive. And if you were to take the Do Things by the Book, you know, a lot of people would question some of the morals on it. I'm not saying I agree with that, but they would question some of the morals. A lot of them would question the legality of it. The whole idea of a money without government is subversive. It's threatening. And it means that it's always going to be associated with illegality. So why don't we talk about that? Is that going to prevent Bitcoin from progressing, or is that going to make Bitcoin?
Well, I mean, Bitcoin might be subversive and revolutionary, but it's certainly not illegal. It's not illegal to have Bitcoin and to hold Bitcoin. Except in a few extreme countries, I think, where they're going to find it very difficult to enforce.
Chad is leading the world in the illegalization of Bitcoin. No, but I mean, it does get used for laundering money, drug dealing, all this kind of thing. So that's why it's associated with illegality.
Right. But what I was going to say about that is that it's not commercial banks that have anything to be threatened of by Bitcoin. It's actually central banks because they're the ones who are promoting their own form of currency and using the power of legal tender behind it. But for a currency to be non-political goes back to the early days of how of how money was started. Gold was non-political when it originally came out. It was the goldsmiths that were originally making gold coins, and then the kings appropriated those coins and stamped their image on it, in effect, appropriating the monetary unit. And that was the title of my paper at George Washington University. The thesis was called The Political Appropriation of the Monetary Unit. So non-political money has a very long, and fabled tradition. So we're just really going back to that. People shouldn't be scared away by money that's non-political.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the future of money, because I think, you know, there was all this mad excitement about Bitcoin 3 or 4 years ago. The Bitcoin price, as I said, went to $1,240 to $1, the same price as an ounce of gold. And now the Bitcoin price is $230, $240, something like that. So it's fallen by 70 or 80%. Though if you'd said 6 years ago that the Bitcoin price will be $230, $240 a coin, nobody would have believed you. But nevertheless, that's where it is. And it's been basically trading sideways for over a year now. It has moments of excitement when it goes up, and then that excitement quickly meets with disappointment and it slips back down again. And the Bitcoin community itself, there's a big kind of it's slightly divided at the moment. There's two factions who both hold a great deal of influence arguing about its future. So where is Bitcoin now, and can it survive?
Well, you pointed out the price increase. I mean, that is probably a little bit unfortunate that it went up so quickly in such a short period of time, because everyone would be pleased if we're sitting at 230 or 240, you know, going several years back. But what we also have to remember is that we've built a tremendous infrastructure in the time period since Bitcoin was at 1240 to now. The broadband support, or the broad-based support that we have for it now, and the applications and the investments and the pervasiveness in other countries is far greater than it was prior to that push-up in price before it went to 1240. So the base of support is strong. The applications are continuing to evolve, and a move now, in an upward price move now, will have so much momentum and so much of a greater base than it did before, that we could see prices that take it over 1240, and then it becomes sustainable at those price levels. And that's not even that far a distance away. It's only a 5x factor from where we are now. So let me speak to the volatility a little bit, because you brought up the fact that, yeah, we've come back down. Well, it's a lot like the price chart of silver. If you if you look at the chart of silver, we've gone up twice to $50 per ounce in silver. And after the first run up in the early 80s, it came down to about $2 for an ounce of silver. People never stopped calling silver money. Of course, it was very volatile. And Bitcoin, of course, is exhibiting the same volatility, but it's only a digital currency that's 5 or 6 years old still. So it's like a little baby that's trying to walk and find its footing. The stability will come once we have the liquidity in the exchanges, once we have more worldwide volume in Bitcoin trading. We will even out the volatility. That's not anything that people should be worried about, or use it as a way to not define it as real money.
Would you be buying Bitcoins now?
I would be, especially if I didn't have any, I would be. But I look at it as the portfolio manager looks at gold, where, you know, the recommendation traditionally is to have about 10 to 15% of your assets in gold. I have a certain amount of assets in Bitcoin, and I follow that. So it's more a percentage of your overall investment.
Okay, now, what are we going to use Bitcoin for?
Well, that's where it gets really interesting, because the Bitcoin community could be, as you defined, going in two different directions for what they want it to be. Especially when you look at this block size debate. Because on the one hand, when Satoshi started Bitcoin, it was meant to be free subsidized transactions to get it going and to bootstrap it. That's why it was brilliant. You could send these microtransactions or large transactions anywhere in the world, any time of day, and everybody paid the same rate. Now, but is the goal to be like Visa or MasterCard and Amex and do 50,000 transactions per second, you know, during peak holiday periods? Is that what Bitcoin was built for? Was unlimited retail payment transactions for free? That's one side. On the other side, you have a group, of Bitcoin people that really see Bitcoin as some type of a reserve asset currency that would be almost a settlement currency at a wholesale level. And in that scenario, you can envisage Bitcoin being a reserve asset on central bank balance sheets, similar to gold and other foreign currencies. It would still be an investment. It would still be something that hedge funds and ETFs are interested in, but it may get to the point where it is too expensive for rapid microtransactions or everybody's cup of coffee. And that's really what we're going to see play out in the future, in which way Bitcoin goes, because we actually don't know yet.
Do you have a view where it's going to go?
I do have a view. My view is that we are going to tend towards more on the wholesale settlement side for Bitcoin, which would mean, of course, larger blocks size than we have today, but in a more prudent growth model. So not rapid block expansion, because I feel that increasing the block size is really increasing and extending the transaction fee subsidy for users. And I think it's important, the security of the network, the hash rate and the computational power behind the Bitcoin network is so important to maintain that I don't think we can avoid developing a mature transaction fee market. Now, you know, that doesn't mean that you'll stop using it for retail, but it means that the people who do use it for retail will value it for what they're doing and they'll be willing to pay a transaction fee.
Describe the future of money. What is money going to look like in 5 years' time? Where's the US dollar going to be, the pound, the euro, Bitcoin, gold? Where are all these things going to be?
Yeah, that's really funny, Dominic, because I go to these markets on the weekend with my wife, because she likes to shop for antiques and stuff. And you'll always see some guy at one of the desks who has the box of old coins, or, you know, the binder of currency, dead currencies that you can flip through. You've probably seen those.
Yes, yes.
And I think that the euro and the dollar and the pound are all going to be in that flip binder one day.
But in 5 years' time?
Well, not in 5 years' time. I'm saying in the future, these paper currencies that governments make are not going to survive forever. And history has shown us that. Now, 5 years' time, you're already seeing articles and comments from the Bank of England chief economist, who says that he wants to get rid of cash. And he thinks we need to get rid of cash, because if interest rates go negative, people will start to pull their money out of banks. So we have to get rid of cash, so they can't do that. But what's he going to replace it with? Well, his announcement was that he would replace it with something Bitcoin-like. He didn't say exactly it would be Bitcoin. You know, it'll probably be some form of GovCoin or B of E coin, which is absolutely different than what we see with permissionless Bitcoin.
Bank of England love Bitcoin. I know the guys who work there and they just love it. This move to a cashless society is very interesting. And I mean, but the pound has been around for 500 years or something in different forms. Obviously, once upon a time, it was a pound of sterling silver. Then a pound was a gold sovereign. And now...
But you're talking about the paper disappearing, though, not the...
I wasn't, actually. I was talking about the currency itself. So you don't think the currency itself will disappear, just the cash? You think?
Well, no, I think longer term, as I pointed out, the currency itself could disappear because it's political. But in the shorter term, which is what you were mentioning about 5 years, I think that, you know, all the talk is towards paper and this cashless utopia. I'm trying to prevent
Denmark's the closest. That's kind of
Sweden and Denmark. You know, but what I'm trying to say is it's not a cashless utopia. If everything is tracked, where's the utopia part? It's more like a cashless dystopia.
So you think we're moving towards a cashless society? Government currencies are going to be digital. So I mean, if you want to just go into the shop and buy a newspaper, what will happen there?
Well, it could
or
be government
sweets. You want to give your kids a pound to buy sweets? How does that work in a cashless society?
Well, in some places, everything's already going on the credit card. But for certain things, as you point out, it'll probably be a form of government digital cash. So government digital cash combined with searchable credit card records is most likely our electronic cashless future. Now, of course, I'm against that. So I think those things are going to coexist with something like Bitcoin that gives people the outlet and the alternative that I mentioned in the beginning of the program by retaining those same three attributes. Now, let me ask you, do you think that the Bank of England or Federal Reserve coin is going to come out with a digital token that gives you privacy, irreversibility, and untraceability?
No.
I don't think so. Now, people are going to still want to retain those attributes. So where are they going to go? And furthermore, if you look at System
people,
D...
People, the evidence of the internet, amazing though it may be, is that people are prepared to sacrifice their privacy to enjoy. So I use Gmail. Google can read all my emails and send me adverts based on whatever emails I've been sending. You know, I know hundreds of people that use Facebook and put up pictures of them and their family doing on holiday or whatever they do on Facebook. Now, these are all sacrifices of your personal, of your privacy. And the growth in the use of Gmail and Google and Facebook shows that, consciously or unconsciously, people are happy to sacrifice that privacy. So we are moving towards a less private society.
You're right that those elements have been sacrificed for those applications. However, I don't think that people have been willing to sacrifice their financial privacy so
well. Well, they are, though, because we're using credit cards and debit cards more than ever.
On credit cards, but there are people, and even the Bank of England studies that show people do not want to give up their cash. Now, that's just in the UK, but let's look at it globally, because if you look at the System D economy, which is the global untracked economy, you know, people call it the underground economy. I tend to call it the free economy. So it's worth about, right now, over $10 trillion a year, the System D untracked economy. Now, that makes it the second largest economy in the world by GDP numbers, with the U.S. being number one. So that means that worldwide, the largest group of transactions are these unrecorded cash transactions in the free economy. They're not just going to evaporate and go away because governments want to have traceable GovCoin. These transactions exist today with paper cash or even other types of instruments, and that's an ideal market for something that is permissionless like Bitcoin that only needs a mobile phone for sending and receiving. So System D could very well be the future for Bitcoin.
Okay, so you're almost suggesting that government money will bring on, in attempting to go cashless, it will bring on its own downfall.
In attempting to go cashless, but I'm not saying downfall because I think that the two will coexist. I think, unfortunately, governments will be bumbling around and over-regulating with Bitcoin and Bit licenses and Bit regulation, that they will have the unintended effect of pushing those uses further underground to the untraced economy. That's going to be their unintended consequence. That's not what they're trying to do, but inevitably that could be what results, especially in the economies around the world that are largely cash driven today already. Bitcoin's sweet spot is not, you know, on Fifth Avenue or Madison Avenue. Bitcoin's sweet spot is in the developing third world.
Okay. So I think it'd be fair to describe the monetary future 5 years from now is more currencies competing.
That would be correct, yeah. And digital bearer instruments, either very strongly Bitcoin or Bitcoin-like.
Okay. Let's pick up on your last statement there, Bitcoin's future is in the third world. I get that. You know, in the same way that the mobile phone succeeded in the third world where the landline didn't, because the mobile phone was cash-based and the landline was credit-based. And if you weren't in the financial system, you couldn't buy a landline. Whereas if you weren't in the financial system, if you're unbanked, you could buy a mobile phone and the airtime. You're thinking something similar will happen with Bitcoin. But at the same time, I don't know what the number is, but I'm going to guess that more than 50% of Bitcoins are owned by for people in the first world.
Well, and the mining and the venture capital happens there as well. But that doesn't have to be the end all. That doesn't have to be the end of it, because people like to say that there's more mobile phones than banks and bank accounts in the third world. That's not even the interesting statistic. The interesting statistic is that there's more mobile phones in Africa than people who have homes with electricity. So then,
more than toilets as well.
And so then that begets the question, well, how do they charge the mobile phones? Well, they're all going to these, you know, community tree stations where you can have 10 people charging your phone at once. That's become their lifeline. That will become their economic lifeline as well, because you only need the mobile phone for sending and receiving something like Bitcoin. The part about where they can spend it and who they can cash it out to and the brokers, that can all be developed. That's an infrastructure that can develop around the technology and the software technology that we have now for Bitcoin.
Okay. Now, we're going to wrap up pretty soon, John, but this has been such an interesting interview. I've just got a couple more questions I've got for you. Now, how excited are you about blockchain tech, blockchain being the tech behind Bitcoin? Is it going to have as big an impact as people say it will?
Well, I was just at a fintech conference, which was an entire week long, and I tend to think of these private blockchains like, you know, people who say blockchain good, Bitcoin bad. It's almost like odorless cologne, because the massive hash rate behind Bitcoin's computational power is what gives it the resiliency. And yeah, Bitcoin was developed for resiliency. It was developed originally for censorship resistance. And those are things that banks and, you know, clearinghouses don't want. So I get that. I get the product pitch of the private blockchain industry to people.
But is a private blockchain just a massive database?
You could think of it as a shared database. Now, the private blockchain advocates will...
But if it's private, it's not shared.
Well, it's shared among the club,
okay,
which I would like to call a cartel.
Okay.
So really what they're doing is they're creating another cartel, and a private blockchain like that would be developed by the banks in a consortium or by Swift in a consortium, they really have to answer to the question of, well, how can this not be used to censor transactions or block weak nations or weak banks out of the system? You know, they can't answer that because it's just building another cartel. I think the problem, though, is in the mind of the fintech executive. The fintech executives and the people, the executives at banks, are thinking of blockchain as a product where you can just pull it off the shelf. It's productized. Give me this blockchain. This looks cool. But blockchain, the way we know it, is actually not a product, but it's a byproduct. And it's a byproduct of a new asset class. And the new asset class is Bitcoin, which gives people the incentive to mine on the primary chain. So people somehow have gotten it inverted where they think of the blockchain as the product rather than the byproduct. And I think it's only a matter of time before these innovative banks or banks that think they're innovative, you know, come full circle and realize that we have to be doing something on the primary Bitcoin blockchain.
Okay, so if I'm interpreting what you said right there, you're very excited about the blockchain, you're very excited about Bitcoin's blockchain, but blockchain tech in general you think has been misunderstood and possibly money's been wasted on it.
Well, capital B blockchain is what I'm advocating, absolutely. But let me give you one more analogy, because I study disruption and I study disruptive trends. Now, we're all familiar with companies like Airbnb and Uber.
Yeah.
Now, can you imagine if the executives at all the world's taxi companies sat around and said, now, we don't really like this Uber thing, but we really like the Uber underlying technology.
Yeah.
Now, let's see if we can use that and get people to drive their cars around so that we don't have to.
Yeah.
That's not the way disruption works. Disruption is not because you can usurp somebody else's underlying technology and disrupt yourself before you're disrupted. Disruption comes from the outside. It comes from your blind spot. So it's just as ridiculous for Hilton Hotel or Marriott Hotel chain to say, let's use this Airbnb underlying technology and, hey, okay, we don't have to have hotels if we can rent out homes, you know?
Okay. Now, one of the reasons that Amazon and Uber and Airbnb and all these other TripAdvisor, all these companies have managed to disrupt so successfully is because they've geared their product to the consumer. So the consumer is getting something better than he is otherwise getting. And so the consumer is turning to Uber rather than turning to traditional
taxi. In a slightly unregulated space, I would add, too.
Yeah, in a slightly unregulated space. Why would a consumer turn to Bitcoin? What is Bitcoin giving a consumer that government money isn't?
Well, there are a lot of value propositions, and it's definitely contextual based on where you're living. So someone in Argentina would want protection from capital controls, protection from wealth confiscation through inflation. Somebody in the first world would want protection from surveillance. So there's many reasons why people would choose to use Bitcoin. But I think the best example for going mainstream is that the applications through the mobile phones are already in place for it to cross the chasm and for it to go mainstream, because you don't have to deal with the holy trinity of mobile phone payments, which is usually the mobile operators, the government, and the banks. Those are the three constituencies, the trinity of constituencies that stop mobile payments. But mobile payments can happen any place in the world today, in any jurisdiction, by people using Bitcoin. So they don't have to wait around for that holy trinity to decide how mobile payments are going to work.
Now, once upon a time we used gold and silver as money. Then we started using paper representing gold and silver because it was more convenient. What made the use of paper possible was the invention of the printing press, so it was a new tech. Then we stopped using paper and we started using, in the 70s, 80s, electronic money, digital money, whatever you want to call it. And because that's more convenient than using paper. Is money basically just a tech?
Well, all the line of examples that you mentioned are all different ways to still use government currency. So it's still different ways to use political government currency. The reason Bitcoin's disruptive is because it changes the monetary unit of account. So just like the largest taxi company in the world doesn't own any cars, which is Uber, the largest financial network in the future will not be owned by any banks. And the most successful medium of exchange slash currency is not going to be a currency that's issued by a government. That's true disruption.
If you were speculating, investing in digital cash and blockchain tech, what's the best investment you could make now?
I think you could almost use the currency as an ETF or a fund, a proxy for the industry. You've never been able to do that before with an investment. We've never had a healthcare currency that allowed you to invest in a sector. But with Bitcoin, investing purely in the currency as a store of value and as an investment for the future is like a proxy for the sector. It's way too dangerous and risky for people to go out there and try to pick individual Bitcoin companies and invest in those stocks, because there's so many of them, and you'd have to know the technology, the management team, the market play. So I would say using the coin itself as a proxy, and if you're not comfortable holding private keys and backups on your own, then go through one of the reputable emerging funds that are in this industry, and there's several of them.
And if you're new to Bitcoin, new to digital cash, what's the first thing you should be doing, apart from reading my book?
You should be studying what the term hash rate means.
Really?
Because that is the single most important metric for Bitcoin. It's what creates the security around the system compared to other cryptocurrencies. And it's what has allowed Bitcoin to become the world's strongest computer in the world, stronger than the top 500 supercomputers combined.
You heard it here, ladies and gents. You should all go away and study what the word hash rate means. John, thank you so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. My goodness me, what an interesting interview. So many interesting stories, so many interesting thoughts, provocative ideas. If people want to find out more about what you do, because you're kind of on the Bitcoin speaker circuit, as well as working with various Bitcoin startups, how do people do that?
Yes, thank you, Dominic. It's been a pleasure being here. People can reach me at my blog, which is themonetaryfuture.com, or I have a very active Twitter feed at John Matonis.
And that's J-O-N Matonis. We'll put a link on the page.
Excellent.
John Matonis, thank you very much.
Thanks, Dominic.
The Virgin Podcast was presented and produced by Dominic Frisby. Special thanks to Nick Fox, Jack Preston, and Christian Anderson Ramshall. Subscribe to the Virgin Podcast at iTunes or via RSS.